Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of the Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, my special guest is Laurie Pelohamo. Laurie is a head of change at a company called Pandatron, which is a company startup he founded doing AI, particularly focusing on coaching and chatbots in the world of work. Laurie is a philosopher, an entrepreneur, and a systems coach, and he lives in Finland. Laurie, we're very happy to have you here. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much, Simon. All good on my end. So yeah, of course, it's dark and cold around here in Finland. It's January, but we're managing. Happy to be here.
Very pleased to have you. So let's start talking about AI and coaching. So I work in the field of coaching. There's many people very interested. There's many people very skeptical. What's your experience so far working with AI and coaching? Let's hear from you.
Sure. That is a rather broad question, I would say. What we have seen is that during the last couple of years, we have managed to transform from the artificial stupid coaching into artificial intelligence coaching, as there has been quite a significant explosion in the AI capabilities you all folks might be familiar with due to the emergence of large language models such as Claude, ChatGPT, etc. And in my opinion, I think AI coaching is growing into this completely new category of coaching, I would say, that in a sense has different affordances, but also different constraints than human coaching, where I'm actually predicting that there is going to be this market bifurcation where on one hand there is going to be AI coaches that are more focused on the large scale transformation and change, as they are able to cost effectively engage with hundreds of thousands of people at the same time on the whole systems level. Yet on the individual level, I think there is still going to be a market for professional executive coaches who, you know, instead of focusing on this more model-based coaching, they are going to dig deeper into the more relational, embodied, and perhaps even psychodynamic domains as well. So yeah, that's why, in a sense, I do think that while the AI imitates the capabilities of a coach and it has to some extent similar effect as a human coach, at the same time it is a singular event where we will actually see in the upcoming years of how much will it continue resembling human coaching and how much it will continue becoming a thing of its own. And that's, you know, in my opinion, the exciting opportunity where I think that, because I see that there is a lot of reactivity going on in the coaching sphere, where they are very easily imposing this close question that, okay, so is AI going to eat coaching or not? I think that's a wrong question. It is going to change coaching, and we will be seeing how will that happen.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. I mean, just for listeners to hear that I'm talking with Pandatron, we're thinking of a partnership and developing the ecosystemic approaches. I mean, in my book, Coaching and Mentoring a Critical Text, I talked about different discourses of coaching, and that there was like the soul guide coaching, which is a deeply human kind of experience, you know. So it's a very nuanced experience. It's very personal. We can talk about spirituality. You can talk about your existential challenges. It's in my view that would be kind of something very kind of human and can be mimicked. You know, you can have leaked questions in AI, but there's something about the connection, the human connection, which is kind of vital there. Another discourse I talked about was what I called psy coaching, which is PSY, which is all the psy professions, and this was kind of a technique driven coaching. So psychology, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, not so much psychoanalysis, but the other side professions, which Nicholas Rose, the famous kind of philosopher, kind of wrote about. And that approach to coaching is much more technique driven. So you get many coaches and they talk about tools, they talk about techniques, they think about behavioral change. It's kind of a behavioral approach. And I've started to see AI do a lot more of that kind of work. So there's a technique-driven coaching and there's a kind of a deeply nuanced kind of human coaching. Is that some of the differences you're identifying yourself?
To some extent, at least in the early market situation. And actually, your fourth category, the network coach, is one of the, I would say, vision models I have in mind on where it's going to develop. And that's actually something we already see happening to some extent in Japan, which is our largest growing market right now, where, how would I say, the coaching does not start from the individualistic standpoint as it does in the West. So in a sense, we do see that this more of a systemic network approach does have a very fertile ground for growth over there. But in the market at large, I do see that this technique-oriented coaching, one could claim that the AI already has surpassed the best technician psych coach on the planet, precisely yeah. Because it can work with the whole field of knowledge of humanity. But that is not something that any human, as wise as they might be, is possible. Now to the soul guide metaphor, I do think that while people can have transference towards the AI, especially if they develop long relationships with it. We already see quite a lot of evidence that people do that with the artificial intelligences that they engage with, just by the fact that because the AI is not mortal, it doesn't understand really what does it mean to exist, because it does not exist. It is language simulation, so therefore it can give you an impression of counter-transference, but at the end of the day, at least if we start from the existential premise, there isn't anything, there isn't an other, at least in the way that we like to conceptualize what an other is. So, which makes the whole concept of AI, and especially AI coaching, and therefore the human-AI relationship, a very delicious and difficult philosophical question, because we do see that many of the concepts that we take for granted do not apply, at least to the extent that we have taken for granted before. So there is a lot of work, I think, here for fresh thinking, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that really interests me. I mean, way back in the day, I wrote a paper called on cyborgs and how human relations to machines, to objects. It's been a long interest of mine, how we relate to objects. And clearly, there is a projection onto our teddy bears as children. There is a transference onto our mobile phones as adolescents. There's very strong attachments, emotional attachments to these kind of objects in our lives, you know, to our homes, to different trees, to different material objects. And yet there's not a counter-transference. Like you say, the counter-transference is the embodied feeling being returned to the client. So the coach, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with counter-transference, it's when the coach or the psychoanalyst experiences a feeling which comes from the client at an unconscious level, and then they return that to the client. So they try and make sense to their own bodies and their own feelings what's going on. So the client might not be aware that they're angry, but the coach feels these feelings of upset and anger in themselves, and they say to the client, "No, are you feeling angry? Are you feeling sad? Because I'm feeling some strong emotions here." So you're using your emotions to make sense of the relationship. This is kind of very much a relationship model, whereas AI is, like you say, language based, and it does something different. I mean, it can trawl through the language and kind of find things which make the client feel like they're experiencing counter-transference or some emotional kind of return, but they're not. And that is a very interesting philosophical and even an ethical question, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that, what I say, it might be that on an unconscious level, it is, we do feel that objects that have a significance to us actually are real and we can relate with. And that's something you usually outgrow. But now when the objects are signifying, well, significant levels of intelligence and depth, it provides this new type of space, new types of relating to objects. And we do not yet know what that will mean, which means that there is a significant responsibility from the ethical perspective for the people who are designing these kinds of objects. And that's where I think my passion for focusing on coaching comes from, because in a sense, I do see that in an ideal instance, these artificial intelligences could help us to understand ourselves, understand each other, and understand the systems we are embedded in way better than we do currently. Because even when we talk about just a single organization, or especially an enterprise level, the sheer amount of complexity makes it impossible for anyone to really understand what is going on in the bigger picture. So theoretically, AI could provide these means for bridge building and understanding the system from a broader perspective, and then catering to the plurality of needs way better than would otherwise be possible.
Yeah, and that takes us on to the discourse I wanted to discuss, which is the network or the ecosystem discourse, because one of my critiques of coaching was that it was too individualized, that it was very much, one, it was too technique driven, and two, it was too individualized. So the individual was seen as an autonomous actor rather than a part of a wider system. And the work you and I are discussing is how we can think about this systemic coaching, this approach of using AI. One, clearly you can scale it because there's a cost saving from using AI. But what other ways are you thinking about how systemic coaching can be used in organizations, and what are you doing already?
Sure. I think one really important thing what we have been working with is grounding the systemic coaching into social constructivist pedagogy. So in a sense, providing people to meet the means to articulate their particular organizational culture, what is working there, what is not working there, what kind of meanings things are given, how are the relationships, how are the power dynamics, etc., etc. So in a sense, if everyone is articulating the social context and the AI is basically listening and facilitating those types of conversation, that allows us to map the basically the subjects in the system, because what usually happens with systemic coaching and especially systems thinking in general is that we do not see that at the end of the day, there is still some kind of a unique being, be it an individual or Dasein, if you're a Heideggerian or whatever, that are embedded in the systems, but they are not the systems themselves. So in a sense, the question for me is that if you map out all of these different subjective interpretations and you see where they converge and where they diverge, what are the conjunctions, what are the disjunctions, you are able to create new layers for problem solving. You are able to create new levels of leadership. You are able to even create new layers of value because, what do I say? I think there is still a sheer lack of imagination when it comes to AI in organizational context, because many are still stuck in the previous paradigm of let's just automate these simple tasks and have humans be creative. Then we're like, what are you talking about? It's like, why aren't we not using machines to become more creative? So I think it is still a bit of a shock to people to even think into that type of direction, just because we still lack to large extent the understanding how embedded we truly are in the social context and in the networks, in the organizations we are operating in. They all form their own realities. And what I would want to do is provide the tools to change those realities to a significant degree and not just, you know, helping people cope within the boundaries that the system enforces them.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. I mean, one of my experiences of coaching and organizational change. You know, I work in different sectors. I work in manufacturing sectors, in health sectors, in humanitarian sectors, in high tech sectors, and across all these sectors, I'm really quite frustrated and shocked by the kind of the HR, the OD functions
mm-hmm.
with this lack of imagination. You know, so yeah. We have done some really interesting work in the past where we've, you know, we didn't have AI, but we had the systemic ideas. So we get 100 leaders across an acquisition and merger project.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how can you kind of support acquisition mergers? We know that 70% of them fail. So how can we do it better? So we got 70 leaders to visit each other, physically visit each other and give each other feedback and learn about each other's jobs across these two companies. And then so the individual got a powerful experience they got an individual coach to debrief their experience, they peer-to-peer experience, so they built actually real networks in the company. And then we did a discourse analysis of all the findings from their reports. So this is where AI would do it much better. Like, you know, this is a physical trawling through kind of manual reports. But it's the same kind of idea where there's something happening kind of individually, but there's something happening in the system, which you'll only get to by analysis of the context of the system and the subjectivities and the discussions people are having. And it was a fascinating piece of work, and it was a major success. But it's very hard to get people to do that kind of work. People are still very much thinking about performance coaching for individuals or team coaching at the most. You know, that we're kind of very stuck when it comes to kind of systems and context thinking. So I see this as a huge opportunity to kind of to really get some depth, get some texture, get some contextual kind of thinking, many, many levels, whatever level you choose to, basically, because AI can go to these different levels. It can go to kind of subjectivities, it can go to technical kind of prowess, it can go to kind of feelings, it can, you know, it's a very exciting project, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also very urgent because I also do see risk, a tremendous risk, if we do extend this way of thinking where we perceive people as objects that we can externally manipulate without their consent and volition, you know, enforce that type of quote-unquote managerial thinking with artificial intelligence. I can already see that it is a slippery slope to type of a system that would be very much advocated by someone like the Chinese Communist Party. And I'm actually serious. Because do not understand that how powerful these AIs can be once we let them in our systems, and that they will enforce a certain way of thinking, they will change us by our interaction with them. That's what technology always has done. Yeah. We create our technologies, and our technologies create ourselves. So then the question is that, okay, if we consider that this direction in the future where organizations would become more emancipatory, where they would become more engaging, where they would become more empowering, where they would become more enabling different types of capacities for people to act and create new kind of value, I think coaching is the way, just because it reflects this certain kind of attitude that does not treat ourselves as some kind of an object, but instead treats us as a becoming that you can give space for growth. So yeah, so even though I do see tremendous opportunity, there is also a tremendous responsibility with a tremendous sense of urgency as well. But it is a interesting challenge in a brave new world. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, before AI, there was a shift, you know, in the digital era towards surveillance, a cultural control of employees, and you know, we've monitored that already. That there's been changes. That's kind of pre-AI. So, like you say, AI could if you have a controller manager kind of ideology, and not just the communist Chinese Communist Party, but in some of the big tech companies as well, for sure.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
There's, you know, there's that kind of surveillance, and it does change the way people see themselves, see their relationships, understand their relationships. It has an impact beyond just being watched. it has an impact internally within us. That's something we know. So trying to work with you and your company to try and do this in an ethical way and understand these challenges is vital work, I think, really, really vital work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there is a need and also a demand for an actually humane narrative that is appealing, because right now I don't think there is one, at least on a mainstream level. And I think it is largely because we, in a sense, have maxed out the previous way of thinking. And now we are at the edge of something new, yet it doesn't yet have an image. It doesn't yet have the concepts that people could easily grab and understand that, okay, yeah, this is interesting. I would I could consider trying this out, which also means that there is, besides just doing things here and there, but I think there is quite a big need for good storytelling.
Yeah.
Which is not based on you understanding all the esoteric philosophical traditions and their vocabulary, but, you know, actually images that feel like something that they have attraction that you could believe in. Because right now many people are scared, are very scared of the coming of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there's a dystopian picture being painted, and you know, there's an occasional utopian flip side to that, but there's not a good narrative, like you say. There's not a social imaginary of how we can work together, and I think that social imaginary needs co-creating and needs storytelling and needs narratives around it, so that people can start to kind of make sense and see a future which is not just dystopian, which is not just kind of that the machines are going to control us, that it's a different engagement with them. And the way we engage, I mean, I think part of that narrative is the way we think about objects and the way we engage them. I'm doing some work with the indigenous people, with a scholar from an Aboriginal scholar from Australia. And this is very interesting as well, around the different ways of thinking about ontology, about how we are in the world and about what material objects mean to us. I think there's a lot of learning from that, that modernity kind of created this split between us and objects and humans controlling the environment, and that needs to, I think, part of the narrative we're going to be trying to co-create is we'll be able to learn from those indigenous ways of thinking about kind of the how we engage with the material world around us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to a significant extent, our social imagination is an outcome of something I call metaphysical hangover, which is, in a sense, this dualistic ontology that has proved itself to be a failure. I mean, of course, there are still some Silicon Valley dudes who believe in eschatology and actually disappearing into a cloud and leaving humanity and viscerality behind is, you know, it is a bit of a wild hypothesis, but I think that because in the far eastern cultures where they don't come from the dualistic ontology, but instead, especially in Japan and perhaps in Korea, they have this something that could be called techno-animistic ontology, which is based on the idea that everything has a spirit. So it is a bit of a wild hypothesis, but I do think that it provides more space for relating to objects in a way where you might not think of them as mere tools for your purposes. And what I say, which is why philosopher Bernhard Spiegler has been quite important to me as this key philosopher of technology in the Western tradition, as he kind of showcased to me that, yeah, we have always been cyborgs since the invention of fire, since the invention of language. We constantly come up with tools that allow us to modulate our environment and give affordances to new epistemes, and which means that technologies are not, you know, good or evil. They are beyond good or evil. They are something he calls pharmacons, something that is both at the same time a cure and also a poison, where it comes back to these questions of what purposes are we going to use these technologies, what are the intentions behind it, how their use influences the larger context, and especially what are the constraints that, you know, don't allow the cure to become an addiction, which is right now, based on the incentive system, I think one of the biggest problems when it comes to technology design, that big companies become big companies because they get their users addicted. And to me, that is a very cynical way of looking into how to create value. It's a very cynical way.
Yeah. The work I'm reading at the moment is around scaffolding as well. I don't know if you've come across this concept of like Nicholas Rose is exploring kind of what it means to be human, and there's all this post-human kind of talk. But what he claims really is that humans are exceptional from other animals, mainly because of their capacity to scaffold, that they can live in. Most animals kind of can develop and use the environment around them in some way, you know. Most animals are that. Humans are quite unique in that they can change those environments and develop those environments and scaffold them. So we can live in the North Pole, we can live in the desert, we can live in urban areas, we can live in such diverse areas. And there's this scaffolding, and they take that even into intelligence, so that our intelligence is not just kind of these neurons clicking in the brain. You know, there's a social intelligence, there's a scaffolding intelligence, which again is similar to the Asian kind of ideas of the spirit world around us, the indigenous ideas. You know, there's this much more interdependent connectivity, this sort of co-learning through the material world around us. I think and this is where this narrative is going to be developed with AI, and I think this is the work which needs to be done, rather than just objectify it as this kind of external thing which is doing stuff to us or, mm-hmm. or going to take us over us.
Absolutely. I think there is a lot of reactivity towards artificial intelligences, which is interesting because I have seen that their reactivity very much reflects the underlying mythologies of a given culture. For example, the Anglo-American sphere, since the Terminator, the usual idea has been that there is this some kind of a colonial outside force that comes and takes over everything and makes your previous world completely obsolete and makes you outcast or even non-existent in a world that used to belong to you. While at the same time, for example, in China, they have a completely different narrative of what's going to happen with AI. They do see that it is going to be something that helps their nation and their great plan to come into fruition. We will see what will happen. They don't seem to be, at least based on the ideas that I have found out, that concerned or that afraid of the outcomes. There is a sense of things being under control, and. You know, actually something that I would sometimes want to see more is having enterprise leaders actually engage into this type of co-creative visioning into the future. What they want their AIs to actually do for their organizations. Yeah. How will AI help them to actualize the purpose of their organization? Because there is a lot of reactivity and also a lot of passivity as well. So I might be just demanding too much from people, but I also think we can and we should do better.
Yeah. And one area interests me is the relationship between, when we coming back to kind of the fundamentals of coaching. So you have an AI coach, and you can scale that. You can use that to go across a wide global organization, and you can. Do some intelligent gathering of many different kind of areas, and you can collate that understanding, and you can help sense make it. But it's the relationship between the AI. If you think about a triad, a client, an AI coach, and then a human coach or a human person. And I'm very interested in kind of that triad. I think people think in dualities too much. They think about AI coach or human coach. Now, I think this triad's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. What I say? Well, for example, in Japan, how we work with is that the AI provides the coaching to the end users, which and then accumulates this data about the organization and what are its issues, what are its opportunities, etc. Create reports based on that. And then these reports are used by professional executive coaches to coach the executives of those organizations. So, which in a sense installs this virtuous loop. And what I say, of course, in an ideal instance, I would wish that the reports themselves would be enough to make change happen. That's not possible because people always have their own impressions of the data that is given to them. They are not looking the system as some kind of external. No, they are very much in that system.
Yeah.
Themselves, which then means that there needs to be these new kinds of alliances with artificial intelligences and professional coaches where we map out what are the problems and what agent is the best at solving it. So because again, we have completely different sets of affordances and constraints,
yeah.
Strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in my work on eco-leadership, again, a concept people find very hard to get together. It's not a difficult concept on the surface, but when you try and introduce it into an organization, it becomes difficult for the organization. Is the idea that the ecosystems we live in are made up of people, technology, and the environment, both the built environment and the natural environment. And I always begin, you know, with this is the ecosystem. Don't think about it just as a network of people. Don't think about it just as kind of technological tools. This is kind of integrated and it's kind of it's contextualized locally, you know, how it shows up in every local interaction. It's there, you know we are cyborgs and we do kind of breathe the air and we do kind of have an environment around us, so what does that mean for any given kind of position? And again, that kind of thinking leans into the Asian way of thinking, the indigenous way of thinking about, you know, and the question is where does AI scaffold into that? You know, how does it kind of how can we think about it rather than just kind of using it as this kind of this other or this tool? How can we kind of integrate that into any given system? And there's not going to be kind of a universal answer either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, good way to think about that question is that, okay, if we continue this stream of thought of indigenous thinking, which, you know, is not possible to the in its original meaning. It's just not possible. However, we can see that there are these certain kinds of elements, for example, the cyclicality of time, that everything is working and functioning in embedded ecosystems where everything and everyone has their own place, etc., etc. So to continue that train of thought, you could make a metaphor about artificial intelligences as these wise guiding spirits in those ecosystems.
Yeah.
Because that's basically, they do have their functions of spirits right now or already. And that's what people don't realize, that in a sense, we are actualizing yesterday's magic with today's technology. And it has already happened. We are in a science fiction movie, whether you like it or not. So yeah. Then the question is, what kind of movie we want to participate in?
Yeah, that's a very nice way to end the podcast, Laurie. We're coming near the end of the time. I ask guests at the end of my podcast two questions, and just any thoughts you might have on what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. And I'm kind of referencing your own work and your own experience. So what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. Have you any thoughts at all? Any scattered thoughts?
Absolutely. it's, how do I say, quite demanding to have these two big questions at the last, but let's do some distillation. So I think the important thing is to find your place. And your place is, you know, who are you in the systems that matter to you, in the networks that matter to you? What is your purpose? Or to put it in a more engineering way, what is your social function? Who are you to others? What others need from you? And are you able to be responsible to deliver that? Beyond that, I just need espresso and obscure books, and I'm fine, man. I'm completely fine. And also, and that kind of thinking is only possible if you see that individualism is a dead end, that you actually are not able to create meaning just for yourself by yourself. It is something that by necessity is co-created, and it's something that is created but also given to you. And then second, well, to good society, I think it's just extending that thought a bit further. Basically, having systems that have the necessary systems intelligence that would allow agents, including people and perhaps these AI spirits, to find their place, that are able to form functioning wholes. And these functioning wholes are, you know, constantly in flux. Situations change, times change, environments change. We need to form new figurations. We need to try out new things. And that's also the fun part. I mean,
yeah,
like when you think about a world where all the problems are solved, that is just one definition of hell to me.
Yeah, sure. So, sure. The fun's in the struggle.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And then comes the question that how do we scaffold the capacity to solve meaningful problems and even identify and conceptualize meaningful problems for agents to solve?
Yeah.
The one feature I do think that the universe has is that there is always going to be problems. So that's not going to end.
That's your new prediction. Laurie, it's been really great talking to you. I think the audience will really enjoy this. So thank you very much indeed. You take care.
Yeah, thank you very much, Simon. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.